Can we find airtight proof for the existence of God? Some may say yes. Others may say no. When speaking of a supreme being, it is difficult to know what standard of proof should be applied. If all things, including reason, our cognitive faculties, if everything derives from the creative power of God, how shall we apply an independent standard of proof to him, to which he must answer? And so for this reason, among others, several Christian philosophers and thinkers prefer to speak of clues to God's existence, or evidence for God's existence, or good arguments for God's existence. In other words, the question becomes, how has God, if he exists, left his fingerprints on the world? And so over the next 6 weeks, we're going to look at a number of lines of evidence, not only for the general existence of God, but also for the truth of Christianity. And these are based on arguments that were first mounted by the first Christian missionaries as they went out trying to persuade the world that God is there and that he has revealed himself through the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And this week we're going to look at the first line of evidence, and that is God's fingerprints in creation and in the human heart. Next week, we'll move on to the person of Jesus and the significance of his teaching and his deeds. Third, we'll look at the case for the resurrection of Jesus. Fourth, we'll look at the role of the Old Testament scriptures in predicting Jesus' ministry ahead of time. Fifth, we'll look at the role of God the Holy Spirit. And sixth and finally, with that evidence in front of us, we'll explore the question of how it's possible to move from doubt to faith. So the case for Christian faith is a cumulative case. I'm not going to give you one knockdown argument that stands independent from everything else. Rather, what emerges is a picture of a cohesive whole. And for today, the question is, why believe? And I've entitled the sermon, The Witness of the Heart. But there are two aspects to that witness, as we'll see in a moment. Well, how did the early Christians who went about teaching that God is there, that Jesus is the Son of God, how did they persuade people that their God was real and that he was unique? Well, we've heard read a passage from the book of Acts in which the Apostle Paul and his companion Barnabas, they're there with a crowd in Lystra, and they say, we are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things, that's false gods, to the living God, who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. In other words, God has given witness that he is there through the world that he has made and through the human heart. And the Apostle Paul elaborates on this same point in his letter to the Romans when he says, what may be known about God is plain to us because God has made it plain to us. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So there are two aspects then that the Apostle Paul drew attention to in giving lines of evidence for God. There are clues in the world around us, and there are clues within us in our own hearts. Now, Paul didn't say exactly how many arguments for God that you can deduce from these two large principles. But many, many arguments have been put forward over the centuries. If you go online, you can find a lecture by philosopher Alvin Plantinga, who's outlined 24 or so theistic arguments. And once again, the object here is not to find proof, at least not in the mathematical sense of the term proof, which is often how people hear that word. but rather to show several different arguments that cumulatively make a powerful case for the existence of God. So let's look at a few. First, clues in the world around us. The first clue is when you ask the question, well, why is there anything at all? The German mathematician and philosopher G.W.F. Leibniz, he asked what is perhaps the most obvious question any of us can ask, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? In other words, why does anything exist at all? Why is there a world, a universe, with all that it contains? And when we look out through the world, we find that everything we set our eyes upon, whether it's great or whether it's small, everything we can see is somehow dependent on something else for its existence. But on the big scale, what is it that brought the universe into existence? Well, many might answer today, the Big Bang. But that really just moves the question back another step. What caused the Big Bang to happen? Scientist Francis Collins, who led the Human Genome Project, puts it this way. We have this very solid conclusion that the universe had an origin, the Big Bang. 15 billion years ago, the universe began with an unimaginably bright flash of energy from an infinitesimally small point. That implies that before that, there was nothing. I can't imagine how nature, in this case the universe, could have created itself. And the very fact that the universe had a beginning implies that someone was able to begin it. And it seems to me that had to be outside of nature. Now, whether you are a scientifically minded person, you might be a cross-evolutionary theory, you might be a strong proponent of the Big Bang, or you might be a Christian who has a more traditional view of Genesis chapters 1 and 3, you're quite convinced that God made the earth, and you don't have a lot of time for evolutionary theory, generally speaking. I don't know where you are on that spectrum tonight. But whichever way you go, the argument that Francis Collins here is making is that even from an evolutionary framework, even from a Big Bang framework, what is it that started it all off? Why is there something rather than nothing? And he concludes that the only possible reason that he can see outside of nature is a supreme self-existing supernatural being, God. A second clue is that when you look out in the world, it appears in some respect that the universe was expecting us. It's an extraordinary observation that our world appears to have been prepared and fitted for life to flourish. Again, to quote Francis Collins, when you look from the perspective of a scientist at the universe, it looks as if it knew we were coming. There are 15 constants, the gravitational constant, various constants about the strong and weak nuclear force, etc., that have precise values. If any one of those constants was off by even one part in a million, or in some cases by one part in a million million, the universe could not have actually come to the point where we see it. Matter would not have been able to coalesce. There would have been no galaxy, stars, planets, or people. Now, some have tried to argue their way around this by saying, well, that's just the way things turned out. Might be a massive coincidence, but, well, that's just what happened. And maybe any other outcome was equally improbable. But does that argument actually have greater plausibility than the existence of a creator God? Alvin Plantinga provides us with an illustration. He says, some thinkers claim that none of this ought to be thought surprising or as requiring explanation. No matter how things had been, it would have been exceedingly improbable. This is perhaps right, but how does it work and how is it relevant? And he gives this illustration. We're playing poker. Each time I deal, I get all the aces. You get suspicious. I try to allay your suspicions by pointing out that my getting all the aces each time I deal is no more improbable than any other equally specific distribution over the relevant number of deals. Would that explanation play in Dodge City? Or we might say at Crown Casino? So not only does it appear that the universe was expecting this, and not only is this a clue for God, but looking back to Paul's words in Lystra, we see a sense of meaning in the world's fine-tuning. When Paul says, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. So for Paul, the regularity of nature, the seasons, the provision of the earth, and our reception of these things and of life itself as good and worth celebrating with joy, all of this is testimony to God's existence. If we don't just stare out into the world and see matter, we see abundance, we see beauty, we see purpose, we see life, we see joy. Now, not to the exclusion of brokenness and pain, but these benefits are really there. Life is worth celebrating. And is not the beauty and joyfulness of life a clue to God's existence? You see, if God's not there, then joy, beauty, the regularity of nature, the seasons, food, love, and life, they're nothing but sensory perception. They're nothing but neurons just firing around in your brain. They don't mean anything. But the fact that we irrepressibly think and act as though life has meaning is a clue. It's a testimony in our hearts, a clue to God's existence. And also, if our sensory perception was telling us a lie when we think there's such a thing as beauty and joy and grandeur, if these things were nothing but chemical reactions in our minds, how could we trust our sensory perception at all? Why should we trust our minds at all? Why should we trust our minds even in scientific matters? It seems better to accept that the universe appears designed and beautiful and plenteous and joyful because it is, because it was made by a great and generous God. And so there are really, broadly speaking, two clues that I've spoken of here. One, that the universe has a cause. It must have a cause. It must have a cause outside of itself. And the second clue is the apparent design of the universe. Now, theologians down through the centuries have spoken of these two arguments as the cosmological argument and the teleological argument. And if you look these up, you can find many versions of them, many defences of them, and go into far greater detail than I'm able to do tonight. But these two are often spoken of when we look at the external world as clues, evidences of God. Well, secondly, having looked at the clues in the world around us, let's move on to look at the clues in our hearts, in our human nature. So we go back to the Apostle Paul. He actually taught that we, as a human race, knew God. We didn't merely conjecture that God might be there based on external evidence, but on a deep level, said Paul, we know God. And there's one particular aspect I want to tap into here, which Paul speaks of in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 to 15, where he writes, indeed, when Gentiles, that's everyone who is not a Jew, because he's speaking about Jews and Gentiles in this particular part of his letter, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves. Even though they do not have the law, they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times even defending them. And when Paul speaks of law here, he's referring to God's law, God's standards, God's moral standards. All of us have moral impulses. All of us live and speak and act and treat others as though some things are right and other things are wrong. Now, that may come as something of surprise, because we are somewhat conditioned today, as we grow up and as we get educated, we think about the world, to assume that moral impulses are just culturally relative, that we shouldn't impose our values on other people. We might have our values, they may not be the values others hold, and we shouldn't impose them. Kind of interesting how there's a bit of an ethical value right there too, isn't there? But when you push this a little bit, it becomes hard to maintain. For example, who of us would think that, say, the principle of equality, the equal dignity of human beings, should only apply where it's culturally accepted? Who of us would argue, just for the sake of argument, who of us would say that women's rights should only apply in Western democracies and not in the Middle East? It's one thing to talk about not imposing our moral values on others when it has to do with general cultural preferences. But who of us is not appalled right now at the Syrian refugee crisis? Who of us would attempt to justify the brutality of Boko Haram on cultural grounds? Who of us would say it's okay for them to do what they do, to oppress, to murder, to treat women terribly, to deny education? That's fine because that's the culture. Nobody's going to sustain that. You see, it's in moments like this. It's in moments where we see a picture of a 3-year-old boy dead, drowned on the beach because of war, and because refugees can't get a passage through to a safe haven. And we're disgusted, we're outraged, we're grieved. It's in those unguarded moments that we demonstrate that we believe that there is a difference between right and wrong, and that there are some moral principles that just must transcend culture. There are some moral values that ought to apply in all places and at all times. Pastor Sam Storms writes that cultural relativism makes it impossible, for example, to criticize a society that practices apartheid or genocide. If cultural relativism is correct, the government-sponsored genocide of the Jewish people can only be quietly observed, not judged. But who of us will agree with that? If valid criticism supposes an objective or impartial standard, then relativists cannot morally criticize anyone outside their own culture. Adolf Hitler's genocidal actions, so long as they're culturally accepted, are as morally legitimate as Mother Teresa's works of mercy. And in fact, this cultural relativism argument was part of the defense presented on behalf of the Nazis at the Nuremberg trials. They said, well, we just simply followed commands. We followed orders or made decisions within the framework of our own legal system, in complete consistency with it. You know, how can you judge us coming from another culture? And of course, the United Nations said, well, that's because there are some things that transcend culture. There is a standard of right and of wrong here that goes outside the bounds of your culture, and you must be held accountable to that. You see, it is possible at times, particularly when nothing vast is at stake, to convince yourself that right and wrong are merely cultural, they're merely malleable, just a product of evolutionary forces. But you see, it's impossible to maintain this. It's impossible to keep it up with complete integrity. And to give you an example, and this is an example I have actually used here before, but it's a powerful one, and so I'm going to share it again. It's a testimony of someone who tried to deny that morality had any objective basis and how at length he wasn't able to maintain it. It's from Jay Budziszewski. He was a PhD in ethics, and he was a former atheistic philosopher of religion who taught at the University of Texas. And after he became a Christian, he reflected on his atheism and he said, "I've already noted in passing that everything goes wrong without God. This is true even of the good things he has given us, such as our minds. One of the good things I've been given is a stronger than average mind. I don't make that observation to boast. Human beings are given diverse gifts to serve him in diverse ways. The problem is that a strong mind that refuses the call to serve God has its own way of going wrong. When some people flee from God, they rob and kill. When others flee from God, they do a lot of drugs and have a lot of sex. When I fled from God, I didn't do any of those things. My way of fleeing was to get stupid." Though it always comes as a surprise to intellectuals, there are some forms of stupidity that one must be highly intelligent and educated to achieve. God keeps them in his arsenal to pull down mulish pride, and I discovered them all. That's how I ended up doing a doctoral dissertation to prove that we make up the difference between good and evil and that we aren't responsible for what we do. I remember now that I even taught these things to students. Now that's sin. It was also agony. You cannot imagine what a person has to do to himself, well, if you're like I was, maybe you can, what a person has to do to himself to go on believing such nonsense. St. Paul says that the knowledge of God's law is written on our hearts, our consciences also bearing witness. The way natural law thinkers put this is to say that they constitute the deep structure of our minds. And that means that so long as we have minds, we can't not know them. Well, I was unusually determined to not know them. Therefore, I had to destroy my mind. I resisted the temptation to believe in good with as much energy as some saints resist a temptation to neglect good. For instance, I loved my wife and children, but I was determined to regard this love as merely a subjective preference with no real and objective value. Think what this did to my very capacity to love them. After all, love is a commitment of the will to the true good of another person. And how can one's will be committed to the true good of another person if he denies the reality of good, denies the reality of persons, and denies that his commitments are in his control? Well, you see, Jay Budziszewski changed his mind. He came to realize that this was an unsustainable way to live. He came to realize that this clue in his heart that was fighting against what he was attempting to achieve with his mind in denying the reality of right and wrong and good and value and beauty and persons, he realized that this clue could not ultimately be suppressed. And he had to come back to a place of integrity. You see, he was torn apart as a person. His mind was saying, there's no God, there's no good. His heart was saying, how can you go on like this? Of course there is. And he was torn apart. And the only way back to integration as a human being was to accept that God was there, that these values did have an origin, they did have a basis. And he turned around and he became a Christian. As St. Paul says, we know God in our hearts, and our sense of right and wrong is a key clue to this. Now, none of us does perfectly what is right and what is wrong. You know, one of the key themes of the Bible is that we've all fallen short of God's standards and we are liable to sin. We go about our lives building our identity on things other than God. And as a result of that, our relationships are fractured because we're all trying to climb up on a pedestal at the expense of others. So if you're an A student here, if you're building your identity on being an A student, how do you view B students? If getting A's is the meaning of your life, don't you look askance at B students and say, oh my goodness, how can you live with yourself? I mean, is it possible to do anything else? No, of course it's not. You see, this tendency that we have to build our identity on the created things rather than the Creator fractures our relationship with Him and fractures our relationships with one another. And one of the things we're going to see as we go through this series is what God has done to mend that fracture. But we do know the difference between right and wrong. And we recognize that we are flawed and others are flawed. We recognize that some members of society have become so warped, they've done horrendous things and they've had to be locked away. Sometimes whole civilizations become barbaric. But right and wrong is still there, lying in each heart as a strong clue to God's existence. C.S. Lewis wrote the following about the impulses of our hearts. He said, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. We feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing." You see, we can tell ourselves that the world is without meaning, that there is no God, that there is no objective right and wrong, that there are only preferences and there are only external constraints. But we won't be able to live that way with integrity. We'll either have to face the despair of Nietzsche and Sartre when they said, "God is dead, there's no meaning, our lives are nothing, all is absurd." Or we can turn around like Budziszewski and say, "These clues in the world, these clues in my heart are real. They're unavoidable. They're irrepressible. Isn't it much more plausible that they arise because God is there?" Well, where does this leave us? Well, this is not the end of the story. As I said at the beginning, we're making a cumulative case here. And it may be that after this, you're not persuaded at all. You're still quite convinced that there's no God, or at least not the sufficient reasons being given to convince you otherwise. Or it may be that you're open to the possibility that God is there, but you're not yet convinced. But at this stage in the series, that openness is really what we're looking for, because we're going next to look at the life and the words and the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth. And you see, if at this point in the series you're able to say, "Well, I don't know whether God is there, but I'm open to the possibility. I've heard some good arguments tonight. I'm not sure if I'm persuaded." When we look at the life of Jesus, you'll be able to enter into that, accepting the possibility that God could be there, that it could be possible that Jesus has come from God. Miracles might be possible. His death and resurrection may be plausible. In any case, I hope you've been encouraged. I hope you've been challenged. Come along tomorrow night if you want to discuss the Bible. Come along next week if you want to hear about Jesus of Nazareth and his words and deeds.